and writers such as Nirad C. Chowdhury and Dr. Zaria Masani have argued eloquently in the case of India that what the empire left behind was not just the railroads and the Indian civil service, but the scholarship of men such as Sir William Jones and James Prinsep, who unlocked the classical language of India and handed that civilization back to itself. Many others have made a similar case. Bishop Michael Nazir Ali, born in Pakistan in 1949, has pointed out that in India and Pakistan there is a common recognition of this complex legacy. As he has said, while there is no doubt that white nabobs made themselves wealthy at the expense of the local population, there were also those, such as Sir Charles Napier, who abolished slavery in the province of Sindh while he was governor in the 1840s, and who famously outlawed the practice of suti, the burning of a widow alive on her husband's funeral pyre. The Punjabis called Sir John Lawrence the saviour of the Punjab, and General John Jacob created the irrigation system around the city of Jacobabad, which made the whole area fertile. The oddity of those who argue against weighing up the various merits and demerits of empire is twofold. First, they say that it cannot be done. There is no way to form the moral calculus necessary to work such things out. Then, they insist that in any case, because of a specific terrible thing that happened, any positives must be discounted. In the case of the academics at Oxford who objected to the study of empire, the whole idea of weighing up the merits of empire was obscene because of the Amritsar massacre of 1919. But the example they give highlights the absurdity of their position. After all, there is a reason why the Amritsar massacre is so well known that it is still remembered over a century later. The brutal shooting at a crowd that led to the deaths of 379 people would not have been remembered if it had been carried out in the 20th century by Japanese or Chinese troops. It would not have been remembered if it had been carried out by Russian troops, and it would hardly have registered if it had been carried out in the 20th century by German troops. It is remembered because the massacre was carried out by British troops. It was not just an exception, but one which caused deep anger and shame in Britain even as it happened. The general responsible for ordering the soldiers to fire on the unarmed protesters, General Dyer, was removed from his command, forced into retirement, and stripped of his pension. Among the many people in Britain who expressed horror at his actions was Winston Churchill, who told the House of Commons in a debate in 1920 that the massacre at Amritsar appears to me to be without precedent or parallel in the modern history of the British Empire. It is an event of an entirely different order from any of those tragical occurrences which take place when troops are brought into collision with the civil population. It is an extraordinary event, a monstrous event, an event which stands in singular and sinister isolation. It may not be possible to answer, but is it not an interesting question to ask why this one monstrous event, or any number of others, could not be weighed up against any good the British Empire did? Does it get outweighed by the British Empire's decision not only to abolish slavery in its colonies, but to police the seas in order to outlaw it across the world? If not, then why not? And if the sins of the West are ineradicable, then are the sins of all other peoples ineradicable too? Or is it only Western crimes that are judged in such a light? Nobody appears to know the answer to these questions. More sinister is the fact that nobody is even meant to ask them. As it happens, there were several coders to the Rhodes Must Fall campaign. Oriel College promised to scrap the Rhodes statue and then promised to save it. The college then agreed to have it withdrawn and also agreed not to do anything about it. This is where the situation currently stands. Since coming to fame for his Rhodes Must Fall activism, Tkozo Kwabe returned to South Africa, where he briefly made headlines in May 2016 when he boasted in a Facebook post about something so black and wonderful that had happened that he couldn't stop smiling. The wonderful thing was that in a restaurant with a friend, he had bullied a white waitress, telling her he would give her a tip when you return the land. When the waitress burst into tears, he laughed and dismissed her tears as typical white tears. Later, back at the University of Cape Town, Rhodes having gone, Kwabe was involved with the new Fees Must Fall campaign and was reported to have whipped a white student with a stick while racially abusing him. Kwabe took to Facebook to object. He admitted that he had hit the student's phone out of his hand with a protest stick he always carries around with him for cultural purposes, but he said that he had not whipped the student. However, Kwabe added, "I wish I'd actually not been a good law-abiding citizen and whipped the white apartheid settler colonial entitlement out of the bastard." The white student told the media that he did not want to be identified. "It's a month to exams. I just need to pass," he pleaded. Meanwhile, in Cape Town, the Rhodes Must Fall campaign went from strength to strength, even after Rhodes had fallen. The following year, Rhodes Must Fall activists burned artwork, set a bus and other vehicles on fire, and petrol-bombed the offices of the university's vice-chancellor. Slavery. In recent years, the critics of the West have marked themselves out through a set of extraordinary claims. Their technique now has a pattern. It is to zoom in on Western behaviour, remove it from the context of the time, set aside any non-Western parallels, and then exaggerate what the West actually did. The case of slavery is a pertinent one. For slavery has been a constant in almost every society since the dawn of recorded history. In antiquity, slaves came from Ethiopia and then farther afield. When the Muslim empires arose, they expanded the trade. As the Muslim empire spread across West Africa during the Middle Ages, it made possible the trading of black slaves across the Sahara. Some ended up in Muslim Spain and Portugal. But when Ferdinand of Aragon and Charles V agreed to a couple of hundred and then 4,000 slaves to be shipped to the New World, they can have had no idea of the change that they were bringing about. From the 1400s to the 1800s, somewhere between 10 and 12 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic to the New World. The slaves that were brought out of Africa not only suffered the indignity of being ripped away from their homeland and taken abroad without their permission, they suffered the additional indignity of having been sold by their neighbours and families. There were times when the Portuguese, among others, seized slaves after a military campaign in Africa, but the overwhelming majority of slaves taken out of Africa during these centuries were a result of man-stealing and selling, where neighbours, enemies, and sometimes families of Africans would sell other Africans on. Some of the few slave memoirs, such as that of Alauda Equiano, attest to this fact. Yet this fact, among others, is a testament to the fact that the history of slavery is far more universally morally compromising than the current discussion is remotely willing to concede. For while historical attention is now almost exclusively interested in one direction of slavery, throughout the last millennium, as throughout history, the horror went in every direction. And while huge attention has been paid in recent years to the trade in slaves that went west, very little has been expended on the trade that went east. So little, indeed, that estimates on the numbers of African slaves who were put into the Arab slave trade are even wider as well as higher in their range than the transatlantic trade. The best available figures, proposed by scholars such as Professor Ralph Austin of the University of Chicago, is that somewhere between 11 and 17 million Africans were traded east in the Arab-run slave trade. One reason why the numbers are so difficult to discern is that, unlike the transatlantic trade, the slaves the Arabs traded were systematically castrated after being brought from Africa, which of course ensured that there was neither a second generation of slaves nor any other descendants. Why is this trade so little focused upon? The scholar Tidiane Diaye is one of those who has questioned this in Le Génocide Voilé, The Veiled Genocide, 2008. He proposes that Arabs have an obvious desire to downplay their 13 centuries of uninterrupted trading in human beings from sub-Saharan Africa. He also suggests that they ignore it because the Arab nations would much rather maintain pressure on the West by continuing to encourage a focus on the transatlantic trade. It is interesting that almost all the scholarship on this area is now being carried out by French or French-speaking historians and anthropologists. The English-speaking countries appear uninterested in the matter. Other areas get almost as little attention. For instance, in the modern interest in slavery, very little attention is paid to the fact that between the 16th and 19th centuries, Barbary pirates, that is, Muslim pirates mainly from North Africa, carried out constant raids not just on European ships, but against coastal towns and cities across Europe. During these years, the Barbary pirates raided and stole inhabitants of the countries on the northern side of the Mediterranean, including Italy, Spain, Portugal, and France. But they also stole people from as far away as Britain and the Netherlands. The people captured, all white Europeans, would then be either used for ransom or sold into slavery. Over the years during which the Barbary pirates operated, it is believed that they stole as many as 1.25 million Europeans from their homes. Of course, there is no movement of reparations for those people or their descendants, and no European has seriously suggested trying to find out where any bill for compensation should be sent. To the extent that it is known about today, it is recognized to be just one of the many bloody and brutal things that went on in the centuries before our own. Worse for the people who suffered it than other forms of slavery, but no morally better or worse in itself. If it is agreed that everybody did bad things in the past, then it is possible to move on and even to move past it. Who wants to litigate or relitigate a past in which nobody's ancestors were saints? Some people do. And they have decided that they can do so by reframing the history of slavery through their own specifically anti-Western lens. Consider Ibram X. Kendi writing about slavery. In his most famous work, he curtly acknowledges that other societies apart from America and European nations also engaged in slavery, but he then sets up a new stratification of bad slavery and worse slavery. In How to Be an Anti-Racist, he writes, "Pre-modern Islamic slave traders, like their Christian counterparts in pre-modern Italy, were not pursuing racist policies. They were enslaving what we now consider to be Africans, Arabs, and Europeans alike. At the dawn of the modern world, the Portuguese began to exclusively trade African bodies." Even here, for Kendi, the question of diversity is of foremost importance. A form of slavery that involves the enslaving of one racial group is the worst of slavery's forms, while a form of slavery that has diversity at its heart is somehow better slavery. It is not just that this is a strange standard to apply, it is also a moral retrofit. Kendi applies a current attitude to the past in order to fit the past into a narrative of constant, otherwise universally uncommon, Western racism. Other examples of similar bad faith arguments can be found everywhere in the current debate on slavery and empire. For example, it is now common to hear the Atlantic slave trade being described as though it had been an act of genocide, though this is, on its own terms, a nonsensical argument. Appalling as it was, the transatlantic slave trade was dedicated to getting as many living people as possible from Africa into the New World. Though many people died on the way, the aim of the exercise was not to kill the slaves, but to get them to the Americas alive so that they could be put to work. That is a great wickedness in itself, but it is far from being a deliberate attempt to wipe out a people. Had the Americans or Europeans ever wanted to attempt such a thing, they might have taken a leaf out of the Arab traders' playbook and castrated all their slaves. Had they done so, then there would be no descendants of slaves in America, just as there are none today in the Middle East. Similar hyperbole has been attached to every aspect of empire and colonialism. In recent decades, it has become increasingly common to talk of the European settlement in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and America as though they involved, by intent, the genocide of the local indigenous populations. Most of the time, this includes reference to the indigenous populations having been wiped out or significantly diminished by the deliberate spreading of disease. This, too, relies on a distortion of events. For, at some point, someone else in the world was going to discover the New World. And whoever did so was, like the Europeans, likely to enter with a level of immunity to disease that the native populations, being more homogeneous and having had less exposure to outside peoples, would not possess. The natural spread of diseases brought in by Europeans could not have been deliberate because the Europeans had no knowledge of immunology, what diseases they themselves were carrying, or how those diseases might spread. Still, none of this has stopped propagandists and academics from asserting that what happened in post-Columbus America, as well as Australia and New Zealand and Canada, was not just genocide, but the worst genocide ever. Here is an academic with tenure at a British university speaking on the subject. "What is the first act of Europe in the Americas? It is the largest genocide that has ever existed on the planet. I actually don't understand the science of this, but apparently there were so many people killed, the temperature of the earth actually rose. Claiming that the Holocaust was not unusual in the West, he went on, "It's not an outlier at all. It's the complete logic of the West. Just the only difference is that it was brought to bear in Europe with people we would consider white, right? If you actually think about the mechanics of what the Holocaust was, genocide, killing millions of people because they'd been deemed racially inferior, we'd seen that before. This was not new. This was not a novel thing. This is kind of the foundation of what the West is." Every aspect of the colonial era is now routinely discussed in the same light. So it has been claimed, for instance, that the British deliberately starved the Indian population on the subcontinent, a claim that is not just without documentary proof, but that runs counter to a most obvious fact, that the Indian population boomed under the period of British rule. Still, this argument, like others, is not enough for the West's detractors. In fact, the forgotten history of slavery like colonialism is not the history of what the West got wrong, but the history of what the West got right. While the history of slavery in the West is obsessively pored over and demands for reparations naturally flow from it, the history of the rest of the world is ignored. Independent Brazil continued to encourage the slave trade right up to the 1880s. The Ottoman Empire continued it even longer. Still today, in Saudi Arabia and across the Middle East, black people are referred to as abid, plural abid, which literally means slave. Being black and being slave still means the same thing to millions of people in the region. In other parts of the world, slavery continues still. I have met slaves myself. I have spoken with them and seen their tears. But those academics, such as Siddhartha Kara, who try to highlight this fact today, get a fraction of the attention accorded to those who want to talk only of Western slavery from centuries ago. Slavery persists today in countries including Mauritania, Ghana, and South Sudan. In recent years, the world watched the Islamic State put thousands of Yazidi women and children into slavery, killing husbands and bartering wives and children in slave markets. In 2020, a Samoan chief in New Zealand was sentenced to 11 years in prison for slavery. He was caught luring people from Samoa to New Zealand, where he would then bind and enslave them in order to enrich himself. In the West, this is unusual and punished when discovered. But in much of the world, the modern slave trade goes utterly unpunished. There are estimated to be over 40 million people living in slavery around the world today. In real terms, this means that there are more slaves in the world today than there were in the 19th century. So this is not a question of historic whataboutery. It raises the question of what might practically change for people today if we spent even a portion of the time that we focus on past slavery, focused instead on present-day slavery, and what we might be able to do about this modern horror. Anyone interested in looking into historical mistreatment of people in any century before our own will find a great amount of material. It happens that our age has decided to burrow down on a couple of issues in particular. But doing so means we have lost the whole context in which these horrors themselves occurred. When we say a person was of his time, we mean the beliefs of those times, but we also mean the hardships of those times. The current interest in slavery, alongside the obsession with privilege, especially white privilege, elides the fact that white Europeans during this time were not living in some type of privileged paradise. For instance, the working classes in the United Kingdom throughout the early 19th century, when slavery was still going on, were in absolutely no position of privilege themselves. When you look at the charge sheet now levelled against the West and everything in its history, you cannot help noticing the complete lack of context, as well as the grotesque lack of balance that exists. What was the situation of a coal miner in England in the 1800s? How much freedom did he have to make life choices or escape the background into which he had been born? What of those forced into child labour in countries such as England, pushed before the age of 10 into dangerous textile factories or agricultural work? As one recent author on slavery conceded, the life expectancy for slaves in Demerara was exactly twice the life expectancy of an industrial worker in Lancashire or Yorkshire at the same time. Is there anything to learn from this? In the case of that particular historian, the only thing to do was once again to talk about the blame of white men and to issue the grovelling, compulsory confession that as a white man he must do better. It is strange to still read of such genuflections after all these years, simply based on race. For if one race of people should be expected to make them, how could any race avoid them? Not just the peoples who traded, but the peoples who sold. What answer can there be, even after all these centuries, to the challenge Voltaire utters in his Essay sur les Moeurs, where he made the observation that while the white Europeans were guilty of buying slaves, far more reprehensible was the behaviour of those Africans who were willing to sell their brothers, neighbours, and children. They reproach our trade, a nation that traffics its children, is even more to be condemned than the buyer. Does this absolve the West of its responsibility? Of course not. But it is a reminder of how strange it is to see only one group of people consistently in the dock for a crime that everybody took part in. There is, too, the question of balance. For it must surely be the case that if there are examples of historical sins, then there are also examples of historical virtues, and that even if the one does not fully wipe out the other, then it stands in some mitigation, at least. For instance, it is true that Britain engaged in the slave trade, and that it took part in a trade in human beings that was appalling. But, as we've seen, Britain also led the world in the abolition of that trade. And Britain not only abolished that trade for itself, but used its navy to seek to wipe out that trade in all parts of the world the navy could reach. If Britain's decision to abolish slavery in 1807 was unusual, more unusual by far was her decision to send the Royal Navy around the world, establish the West Africa Squadron based at Freetown, and grow the fleet until a sixth of the ships and seamen of the Royal Navy were employed in the fight against the slave trade. The cost of this extraordinary decision was not only financial. It was paid for in British lives as well. Between 1808 and 1860, the West Africa Squadron captured 1,600 slave ships and freed 150,000 African slaves. They also lost a huge number of personnel themselves. More than 1,500 men of the Royal Navy were killed in action during this period, and the acts of bravery and selfless heroism of those men is worthy of some note, surely. Anthony Sullivan's recent history of the operations of the Royal Navy's West Africa Squadron is one rare work to highlight the extraordinary bravery of these British sailors, chasing boats across the oceans, boarding them, and fighting for their own lives and for the lives of the slaves that they invariably found stowed away in the holds of ships bound for a wide variety of countries. It was a game of cat and mouse across the high seas, with standoffs and guessing games about slave ships trying to pass themselves off as other vessels. Until the British sailors boarded the ships and searched for themselves, they never had any certainty that they were right in this high-risk strategy. It is a tale of great heroism that carried on for 6 decades. Do these efforts count for anything? In the retributive anti-Western game that is currently going on, it seems they do not. Instead, we hear only of guilty men. Such as claims made by activists that Britain's greatest maritime hero, Admiral Lord Nelson, was an ardent believer in the slave trade. Such claims are invariably made in order to demand, as it was on that occasion, the removal of Nelson's column in Trafalgar Square, London. In fact, when this campaign erupted in 2020, it soon transpired that the letter condemning Nelson as a slaver was, in fact, a forgery. Specifically, it had been forged by the anti-abolitionist movement when the slavery debate in England was still ongoing. But by the time this came out, the drive-by shooting on another hero of the West had been achieved. BLM activists had used a forgery created by anti-abolitionists to bolster their own more contemporary cause. It was an ethical and a scholarly failure. But not many people stayed around for this debate. Still, to see the full unfairness of the anti-Western game of our time, it is enough to note simply how one individual is now judged, and that individual the greatest of them all. Churchill. One of the historic figures who has received the most targeting in recent years has been a person who, on the face of it, might seem a surprising target for cancellation. Until the last few years, Sir Winston Churchill had generally been revered as one of the most successful and admirable figures in Western history. His arrival into the position of Prime Minister of the United Kingdom in May 1940, at the very moment that Adolf Hitler began to unleash his blitzkrieg on the West, was later described by Lord Hailsham as the one time he could discern the hand of God intervening in human affairs. Churchill had been right on many things in his long career, as he had been wrong on some. But identifying the menace of Hitler early on in the 1930s and urging rearmament and facing down the appeasers made him, even before his conduct of the war, one of the great figures of any period in history. Many people talk of fascism and anti-fascism, but here, without doubt, was the 20th century's greatest anti-fascist. If anything, His reputation only grew in the decades after his death. In 2002, he beat off all competition to be voted by the British public as the greatest Briton of all time. But in recent years, there has been a slow but steady assault on Churchill. While Hollywood movies such as Darkest Hour 2017 have continued to play the heroic Churchill out to packed cinemas, a slower burning but equally virulent strain of anti-Churchill sentiment has spread. There are many things that distinguish this movement, but among the most interesting is how extraordinarily historically ignorant its proponents are. Take a panel discussion that took place at Churchill College, Cambridge, in February 2021. This event, at a college named after Winston Churchill, the only time a living person has been so honoured, was titled "The Racial Consequences of Churchill." The three panellists, Dr. Onyeka Nubia, University of Nottingham, Professor Kehinde Andrews, Birmingham City University, and Dr. Madhusri Mukherjee, were united in their virulent hatred of Churchill. The person who chaired the discussion was one Priyamvada Gopal, who happens to be a teaching fellow at Churchill College. In recent years, she has distinguished herself on Twitter through her anti-white race baiting. This has included such gems as "Abolish Whiteness," "White Lives Don't Matter," and her claim that she has to resist urges to kneecap white men every day. None of the participants are specialists in 20th century history. One of them is principally a physicist. But none of this prevented the participants from acting as supreme judges on Britain's wartime leader. Their lack of expertise showed itself in the fact that the participants made the most basic historical errors. For instance, at one point, Dr. Nubia made the schoolgirl error of confusing Ernest Bevin with an Iron Bevin, perhaps believing that the two men were one and the same. In any case, an Iron Bevin was not even in office at the time that Dr. Mukherjee claimed he was responsible for British government policy. Still, it was not in the details, but in the vast sweeping claims that these non-specialists levelled, that something important could be discerned. For instance, throughout the event, Professor Kehinde Andrews, one of the panellists, made claims such as these. The British Empire was far worse than the Nazis. The war would have been won without Churchill. Britain would have won with almost anyone else in the position of Prime Minister. The Holocaust was not unusual in recent history. And, in any case, the victory of the Allies over Nazism was not especially significant because all we really did was we shifted from an old version of white supremacy to a new version of white supremacy. There were no depths to which the participants would not sink. At one point, one of the participants started to snark at Churchill for being a coward. I mean, was it Churchill out there fighting the war? 'Cause I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I'm pretty sure he was at home. You must wonder how hostile somebody must be to ask why a Prime Minister who, as a young man, saw action on four continents and volunteered to fight in World War I, should, in his 60s, have fought on the front line of the conflict like some medieval warlord. Among other attempts to denigrate Britain's wartime leader, the participants strangely also taunted Churchill for losing the 1945 general election. This is of a piece with recent Churchill criticism. In 2021, A new book attacking Churchill used every possible line of attack, including attacking him for drinking too much. Elsewhere, the book's author claimed that Churchill was never really a well-travelled man. Which makes you wonder what a well-travelled man would look like, if not like Winston Churchill. Although all these claims show a deep animus, most are essentially frivolous. But the most serious allegations made against Churchill are accusations that have in recent years also come to the fore. When the BLM movement spilled out from America into Britain in May and June 2020, the statue of Churchill in Parliament Square immediately became one of the focal points for protesters. The statue was repeatedly graffitied and otherwise defaced. At one stage, a BLM banner was taped around the statue's waist and the statesman's name was crossed out with black spray paint. Then, beneath Churchill, the words "was a racist" were added in more black paint. It was in reporting this protest that the BBC ran the headline, "27 police officers injured during largely peaceful anti-racism protests." A headline only bettered in our time by CNN a month later having its reporter standing in front of a burning city with the tagline, "Fiery but mostly peaceful protests." Such was the sensitivity around the BLM attacks on the wartime leader's statue that it was soon boarded up and then completely encased in a metal box so that protesters could not get at it. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, promised that the status of the statue would remain under review by the Greater London Authority and the Met Police. During a visit to London by Emmanuel Macron in June, the shame-faced British authorities took down the coverings around Churchill's statue. The French president's visit was to commemorate the 80th anniversary of General de Gaulle's appeal to the French people to resist the Nazi occupation of their country. So the British authorities may have been aware of the impression it would give if, 80 years after that occasion, London could not even display a statue of its wartime leader. But no sooner was Churchill allowed out than he was defaced again. In September, the words "is a racist" were added to the base of his statue, this time in yellow paint. And nor were such attacks limited to the United Kingdom. In the heart of Churchill Square in Edmonton, Canada, is a life-size statue of Churchill unveiled by his daughter in the 1980s. In June 2021, it was the turn of this statue to be attacked. Activists poured red paint over the figure so that it dripped down the bronze and covered everything from the statue's face to its base. One local activist, who had previously called for the statue's removal, responded by saying, "Here's an idea. Maybe let's not celebrate, commemorate, and otherwise memorialize warmongers and genocidal maniacs. Stick him in a museum where he belongs, with a proper chronicling of his views and atrocities." The best that the local mayor in Edmonton could do in response to the attack was to say, "I don't know the intent behind the vandalism, but I know historical monuments and sculptures here and elsewhere are at the heart of an emotional debate regarding what legacies and stories we venerate as a society. I believe there are more productive ways to move society along towards a more inclusive and uplifting future." One reason why such mealy-mouthed criticisms became the norm was for the same reason that websites like the BBC's started to insist on putting the case for the prosecution under any piece explaining such attacks on Churchill's reputation. The attacks tended to follow the line that Foreign Policy magazine did when it allowed one of its authors to describe Churchill in passing as an avowed racist, as though this question were not even arguable, simply settled. Or as CNN did when it ran a piece justifying the Churchill statue defacement in London with the headline, "Yes, Churchill was a racist. It's time to break free of his great white men view of history." The article went on to accuse Churchill of white supremacism. The accusations against Churchill always boil down to the same few things. The first is that he occasionally expressed views which were 19th century in their attitudes. As a product of 19th century England, this is hardly surprising. But the tactic against him is to seize something in his life that he got wrong or said wrong and use it to wipe out everything else. As with Rhodes, much of this relies on outright lies. For instance, Noam Chomsky, among others, has claimed that Churchill advocated the gassing of Iraqi civilians in 1919. What such critics fail to realise is that Churchill was advocating the use of tear gas, not mustard gas. Then there is the example of the Bengal famine of 1943-44. This terrible famine, in which official estimates say that upward of 1.5 million people died, was started when a cyclone hit Bengal and Orissa, destroying the rice harvest. Local officials failed to deal with the problem, as did the Viceroy and others. The cabinet records in London show that Churchill insisted that famine and food difficulties in the area be dealt with. Churchill's recent critics accuse him of failing to send sufficient grain to India to alleviate the famine, distort the historical record, and fail to note that the truth is that even at the height of World War II, Churchill personally saw to it that emergency grain supplies reached India from Iraq and Australia. While the claims against him have been made by utterly inept figures, infinitely better qualified figures, including Tirthankar Roy and Amartya Sen, have proved how false such claims are. Ordinarily, the evidence of such experts would have proved conclusive. But in recent years, even without any grounding in fact, the claims against Churchill have grown. Activists have built on the work of sloppy writers to claim that Churchill didn't bother with the famine in Bengal, that he wanted there to be a famine, and even that he was gleeful that people starved so long as they were Indians. Such claims are wholly disproved by the historical record, but have gained some currency thanks to the ferocity of their repetition. As Churchill's most recent biographer, Andrew Roberts, has written with Zudito Gebreyohannes, it is unrealistic to imagine that anyone else in Churchill's place could have given more attention to the famine than he did, when a world war was being waged on multiple fronts. It sometimes seems as though there is nothing that Churchill could have done to please his latest critics. In 2019, the then Labour Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, was questioned about Churchill during a public event in London. "Winston Churchill, hero or villain?" he was asked. McDonnell, a self-described Marxist and socialist, replied simply, "Tony Pandy, villain." This referred to an incident in South Wales in 1910 when Churchill, as Home Secretary, sent police in to deal with riots that had erupted over a miner's picket line. One miner was killed in the ensuing violence. And there is surely something extraordinary in this. A wholesale lack of ability to weigh up good and bad. The events at Tony Pandy are disputed, and nobody would seriously lay the death of that one miner at the hands of Winston Churchill. But so what if they could? If that one Welsh miner did die because of the direct decision-making of Winston Churchill, did nothing that Churchill achieved in the decades after 1910 make up for that? Does his central role in defeating fascism count for nothing against this? Historical judgment calls like this tend to come with complications. The first is that they are so astoundingly one-directional. While he was Shadow Chancellor, MacDonald was happy to praise Mao Zedong and wave his little red book in the House of Commons, recommending its contents to the House. During his life and career, Chairman Mao is estimated to have been responsible for the deaths of around 65 million people. Yet this fact can be brushed aside by Labour politicians such as MacDonald and former Shadow Home Secretary Diane Abbott, who once said that, on balance, Mao did more good than harm because he led his country from feudalism. It seems right to ask exactly what accounting system is going on here. How can it be that a left-wing dictator can kill tens of millions of people, yet still be praised for great leaps forward in agricultural matters, whereas Winston Churchill can help save the world from fascism, yet be forever damned because of a Welsh miner's death 3 decades before? There is something so outrageous in this that it must be put down to a desire to win some other political fight. Something else is going on in the attacks on Churchill, which are a possibly deliberate attempt to cause enervation. It is almost impossible to look at people trying to weight the scales of history in such a fashion and not sigh with exhaustion. If what Churchill did in his life doesn't count for anything, then it is hard to see how any human action counts for anything. If Churchill's good points cannot outweigh any bad points, then no one can ever do enough in their lives. In other words, if we cannot get Churchill right and get him in a proper perspective, then there seems little point in trying to do so with anyone else. Finally, there seems little point in trying to do anything good ourselves. The attacks on Churchill make all human endeavour seem futile, because if even defeating the greatest evil in history will count as nothing, and you will not be lauded for it in your own country even half a century after your death, then what good deed could ever count for anything? Still, this doesn't quite answer why Churchill should attract so much opprobrium. Why it should be the case that on issue after issue his reputation has been smeared and sullied, and his achievements so dishonestly assessed. To understand what is going on here, it is necessary to consider this not at a historical level, but at a religious level. Since World War II, Churchill has been revered across the Western world. Perhaps more than any other single figure, he has been seen as an example of a great man, and a great man produced by the West. He is a figure in whom the public still feels huge pride. The knowledge of him and the memory of him stirs them. They may not believe in God, but they believe in Winston Churchill. That is why cinema audiences got to their feet and cheered at the end of Darkest Hour. It is why books on Churchill and memorabilia to do with him still sell so strongly. Because his story is a heroic story, demonstrating the greatness that mankind can aspire to, and the heroism that men can achieve. This, then, is the reason why Churchill must be particularly assaulted. Because as long as his reputation stands, the West still has a hero. As long as his reputation remains intact, we still have figures to emulate. But if Churchill can be made to fall,
Why, then one of the great gods, perhaps the greatest of the West, falls. And then, well, anything might be forced upon a people so subjected and demoralized. The academics and others who assail Churchill know what a holy being he is. They know how much he is revered. And it is for precisely this reason that they assault him, because they want to kick the white men. They want to kick at the great man view of history. They want to kick at the holiest beings and places of the West. They choose their targets well. Statues. In Britain, as in America, this kicking at the foundations has taken on a special fury in recent years. Just as the Floyd protests in America began with debatable figures and then roared right toward the center of the nation's history, so in Britain it burned from the outside in at a record pace. In the days immediately after the death of George Floyd, a crowd in Bristol attacked a statue of Edward Colston, 1636 to 1721, a local merchant and philanthropist who had been involved in the slave trade. As the police looked on, the crowd pulled the statue from its plinth, rolled it down the street, and hurled it over the docks into the harbour. As in America, there was a clear elation in the air, a feeling that here, in this permissible vandalism, was something to do, a way to right something. Like their American counterparts, the British authorities also began to remove statues preemptively, hoping to stay one step ahead of the mob. A statue of the merchant Robert Milligan was removed from its plinth at London's Docklands because of his connection to the slave trade. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, announced the setting up of a commission to look into what statues and monuments might need to be removed across London. The Robespierrian title of the commission was The Commission for Diversity in the Public Realm. The likely conclusions of the commission could be guessed at fairly easily. Its members included Lynette Nabossa, a community builder, who had claimed that white supremacy was a uniquely British thing and that the United Kingdom is the common denominator in atrocities across the world. There was also Andrea Emmeleife, who had already expressed her approval of guerrilla-style statue removal, and another member, Toyin Agbetu, who had distinguished himself in the past by turning up to a service at Westminster Abbey where he had heckled the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Queen before threatening to punch a black security guard as he was being removed. A finely unbalanced panel, in other words. Just as a guilty verdict had already been declared on the statues that were still standing, so the verdict was also already in on what memorials should replace them. The mayor, who had put together the commission, pledged that just as the old statues would come down, so new ones would go up. He said that new memorials for London would include ones for the Windrush generation and one for Stephen Lawrence, a black teenager who had been murdered 30 years earlier, as well as a national slavery museum. In other words, once again, the whole national story was to be turned upside down. As with the 1619 project, a story of accomplishment was to be turned perfectly deliberately into one of oppression. A story of heroics would be turned into a narrative of bigotry. And anyone who did not agree to go along with this shift in the narrative could expect to come under fire themselves, however unknown they might be. After the protests in Washington, D.C., a video went around online of three women, who happened to be white, trying to scrub BLM graffiti off the Lafayette building. The video showed the women being berated by a passing motorist. "Why do you want that to come off?" demanded the woman in the car. "Because this is a federal building," said one of the women. "So you don't care about black lives, then," said the woman doing the interrogating. "That's not at all what we're saying," one of the women said. "We certainly do care about black lives." "Not enough to leave up a message," shot back the woman in the car, making the removal of graffiti yet one more entry in the ever-lengthening list of racist acts. Similarly, after one of the BLM protests in London, a group of young British people turned up to clean graffiti off the public monuments in Whitehall with their own hands. The young men and women turned out to be members of the Household Cavalry, who came around after the protests had dwindled and began to scrub the graffiti off the statue of Earl Haig on Whitehall. This was shortly after at least one other protester had been pictured clambering over the cenotaph and defacing Britain's memorial to the fallen of the two world wars. These and other Whitehall monuments had been spray-painted with ACAB, All Cops Are Bastards, and other BLM slogans. A young woman with a camera phone sought to shame the young men and women for cleaning the monuments. Other protesters taunted the young soldiers for their acts. First, for clearing away some of the protest banners that had been left littered around Whitehall, and second, for daring to try to clear the graffiti. "Couldn't even wait a day," one woman taunted them. "Not one day because of their precious memorial." Of course, for any British person, these memorials are indeed precious. They represent the sacrifices that every family in the nation made to keep their country free from tyranny. For most British people, the sacrifice that previous generations made on their behalf isn't a funny or shallow thing, or something to be derided. It is deep, and not up for negotiation. But this desire to mock the West's holy places seems almost unassuageable, and it has spread everywhere. In Canada, during the BLM summer, crowds had already pulled down a statue of Sir John Macdonald, Canada's first Prime Minister, and the nearest thing the country has to a founding father. In the summer of 2021, there was a revived burst of this anti-Western iconoclasm. Until 1982, Canada had celebrated Dominion Day on the 1st of July, but Canada Day was deemed to be more inclusive, and that agreement almost held until 2021, when the anti-Canada feeling inside Canada was growing. Another statue of Macdonald was pulled down, and then, on the day itself, crowds of people gathered on the Parliament Hill to chant, "Shame on Canada." Prime Minister Justin Trudeau ordered the flying of the national flag at half-mast. And across the country, protesters seemed keen to rip out any and all monuments to the country's western past. A statue of the explorer Sir James Cook was pulled down, and then in Winnipeg, huge crowds armed with ropes and hooks pulled the vast throned statue of Queen Victoria off her plinth. They then performed the same ritual act of vengeance on a statue of the present monarch, Queen Elizabeth. In only a few years, a day of celebration of Canada's Confederation as a country had turned into an opportunity for an orgy of anti-Canadianness. During this strange stampede in Canada, as in so many other cases, the whole history of the country and the wider West became strangely perverted. Both truths and lies were exaggerated, and then spun along through a cycle of outrage. Assumptions of obvious guilt were made, followed by a scouring search for culprits to blame. Always the indictable force is the West, and the institutions and ideas that have made up the West. History becomes the history of Western sins, and ignorance reigns, not only over anything good the West ever did, but over anything bad that anyone else has ever done. The Great Divestment. Fixed in this narrative is a stampede inside the West to rid itself of its own history. And for some years now, strange outbursts have begun to break out. For instance, in recent years, universities and other public institutions have started to order historical audits of themselves to see whether, or to what extent, they might have benefited from the slave trade or empire. The guilty verdict is always preordained, but precisely what should be done to make amends is never clear. In the meantime, these strange spasms can break out anywhere. In 2019, Cambridge University announced that it was going to carry out an audit over whether or how it may have benefited from the slave trade. One consequence came in May of that year, when it was announced that St. Catherine's College had removed a bell that it had on display. The bell in question was held under suspicion for having once been on a slave plantation, and so it was shuttered off from public view pending further investigations into the inanimate object. At such moments, you can begin to wonder whether we are getting into the realms of Narnia-like magic. Do such items carry some sort of dark matter with them? Will the plantations come back if the bell is rung? It remains unclear. A senior tutor at St. Catherine simply stated that the college wanted to reflect on our commitment to diversity, inclusion, and asking challenging questions. What is clear is that no institution can afford to get left behind in the current moment. In London, the British Museum has been put under pressure once again. In August 2020, it caved to pressure to remove the bust of the museum's founding collector. The bust of Hans Sloane was removed from its pedestal and resituated to a cabinet because, it was explained, his collecting was partly financed from the labour of enslaved Africans on his wife's sugar plantations. This inevitably led to renewed calls for the museum to return various items in the collection. For once, the demands to return the Parthenon marbles to Athens were overshadowed by demands to return the Benin bronzes to the country that is now Nigeria, from which the bronzes originally came in the 1890s. An influential book followed, erroneously claiming that the bronzes were looted by an expedition of British men in an example of racism, corporate extractive capitalism, and proto-fascism. In fact, the bronzes were seized as war booty after an expedition of British men were butchered, perhaps lost their lives, the author of Brutish Museums puts it. In fact, the four British men were sacrificed by the Oba of Benin, who was still operating a slave market. The severed heads of the British men appeared a day later with stick gags in their mouths. But, as with so many other occasions in the present moment, nearly all actual knowledge of what had happened at the point in question had been long forgotten. The history had been rewritten in the same one-note tone as everything else. A story of Western racists taking advantage of innocent natives. Such was the pressure on one institution that another institution soon buckled. In April of the following year, the Church of England announced that it was sending back to Nigeria two Benin bronzes that were in its collection. It transpired that these two bronzes had in fact been given to the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Robert Runcie, in 1982. The gifts had been given by the University of Nigeria. So now, in a fit of guilt, the C of E announced that it was returning some recent gifts, as though to get stolen property off its hands. Interlude. Reparations. What can the West do with such a catalogue of sins being levelled at it? What could anyone do? How can these wrongs be righted without punishing the innocent and rewarding the unworthy? It is a puzzle that hovers over any and all historic injustices, and it requires a considerable amount of care to wield this moral scalpel at all, let alone to wield it without killing the patient during surgery. The first thing to do is to work out whether the wrong has actually occurred, and what the extent of that wrong might be. Next, it is necessary to work out who the person is who has been wronged, and who the person is who has done the wrong thing. If forgiveness or apology is required, then who can offer it, and who can accept it? If some kind of compensation or restitution is required, then where will it come from, and who will it go to? These are just some of the questions that linger in the debate over the history of the West. And this process of questioning is not in itself unusual. All of history and geography is claim and counterclaim about who wronged who, and which group of people still owes another group of people for a historic wrong. Sometimes those fights end up being territorial, as in Cyprus or the Western Sahara. Sometimes they are about which group is seen to have come out on top in the same society. Throughout history, such conflicts have died out and been capable of being reignited again with extraordinary ease. It is not difficult to whip up animosity against a particular group by portraying them as having unfairly benefited to the detriment of others. History is chock full of versions of how this plays out. So an extraordinary amount of care is required if you are going to make claims of wrongdoing against whole groups of people, let alone whole ethnic groups. It might be no surprise that none of the necessary moral finessing is performed in the current day when it comes to the West, or when it comes to the ethnic group that has made up the majority in the West. Quite the opposite, in fact. The opponents and competitors of the West seem thrilled not only to be able to say whatever they like about the West, but to make extraordinary demands of it. The more outrageous, the better. Again, none of this is especially new, but it has picked up pace in recent decades. Demonization of the West and of Western people is now the only acceptable form of bigotry at international forums such as the United Nations. If demonization of the African nations was the norm, then this would be easily identified. The same would go for any other culture, except for the West. Anyone who doubts that should cast their minds back just two decades to an event that happened in the coastal city of Durban, South Africa. The
World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia and Related Intolerance took place between August the 31st and September the 8th, 2001. Unsurprisingly for such an event, under such auspices, the conference was less about tackling racism and intolerance than it was about showcasing these things. The State of Israel came in for particularly virulent attack, to such an extent that some of the Western countries even began to get so uncomfortable about the amount of abuse being levelled at a conference meant to tackle discrimination that the United States and Israel walked out. Other Western countries threatened to walk out, but stayed. The outrages of this conference, which took place under the auspices of the UN, were soon overshadowed by the greater outrages that happened in New York, Washington, D.C., and a field in Pennsylvania just 3 days after the conference ended. But everything that happened in Durban should have been better understood, because every detail of it demonstrated the orgy of anti-Westernism that not only set the scene for 9/11, but had already become the acceptable default position of anti-Westerners around the globe. The self-important declaration that was published at the end of the conference ticked all the right boxes for the various anti-Western powers.